Put that coffee down. Coffee's for closers only.
G'day world, you're listening to Cameron Riley on the Podcast Network, Thursday the 14th of June 2007. My guest today, one of Australia's most successful internet entrepreneurs, Melbourne boy, Adrian Giles, co-founder of Hitwise, the internet measurement competitive intelligence company that has been around about 10 years and was recently sold to the US company Experian for a little under 300 million Australian dollars. Welcome to the show, Mr. Giles.
Thanks, Cameron.
Mate, congratulations, first of all, on the sale. It's a pretty big thing for an Australian internet entrepreneur to have that kind of success on the global stage these days. How do you feel?
Yeah, thanks. I mean, everyone feels pretty excited and happy about the deal. It's been a long, you know, nearly 10 years for us since we started the company, and, you know, we always kind of built it to sell it eventually, and so it's quite rewarding and satisfying to finally have a end result.
So you did build it to sell it. That's interesting. I got the impression that you guys, you know, when you've taken 10 years to build it, that doesn't sound like a build-to-flip model. Usually the build-to-flip guys are trying to get out in 2 to 5, aren't they?
Well, that's probably an unrealistic, that would have been an unrealistic expectation for us to have, you know, a 2 to 3 year horizon. And when I say build to sell, what I mean is build to provide a return for investors and shareholders and founders at some point, whether that be through a listing or through a trade sale. It ended up being a trade sale, but for the past few years, it was actually always intended to be a listing.
Yeah, I remember I've read over the last few years talks of you aiming to list it on NYSE at one stage and then on the NASDAQ. I believe that once word got out that that was your intention, you started to receive some offers?
Yeah, that's pretty much how it happened. I mean, we'd always geared the company over the last 3 years since launching in the US in 2003. We'd really wanted to put it on NASDAQ. That had always been the objective, and that was the objective right up until we probably would be on NASDAQ now, actually, or at least in the next quarter. But when I suppose word of that got out, a lot of interest came our way, and you know, we felt we had to do the right thing by all the shareholders and explore that interest appropriately, which we did. And so we appointed Deutsche Bank in the States to kind of guide us through that process, and they did a good job of that. And eventually we whittled that interest down to, three or four players, and finally chose Experian because we felt that they kind of represented the best fit for the company from a product, cultural, and growth point of view.
Let's go back to 1997. How old were you guys, yourself and your co-founder Adrian Barlow, when you started the company?
23 or 4, I think.
What the hell do 23-year-olds know about starting a company? Was this your first startup?
Yeah, it was the first one that we'd started. I think we just knew at that point that we wanted to build our own business, and that was a attitude that we developed. Well, I mean, I can only speak personally, but I know Andrew was similar, that we developed when we were younger, and knew that that was the only way to really, build up your own control, your own experience, your own destiny, and ultimately, create, real wealth from it all, was in owning your own business and building your own business. And so that passion and drive to have our own business was there from a pretty young age.
Is that something
so
you think you got?
It took a while to get it started, but 23 probably, I suppose, isn't that late.
Is that something you got from your parents? Where did this?
A little bit. My parents were in hospitality, so they'd always had their own hotel businesses, like pubs.
Right.
And I think it was just a realization that's, if you don't have your own business, you're effectively working for someone else and building up their business and their equity. And it just didn't make any sense to do it any other way. Why would you want to work for someone else? It just kind of didn't make a lot of sense to me. And so I'd always said that the only way I want to live my life is working for myself.
What did you do after school, between school and starting the company?
I worked a little bit in hospitality because that was my family background. So I ran a few pubs around Melbourne, worked in, built a little cash management program whilst working in hotels that was actually what got me interested in IT, and ended up selling that cash management program to a few other pubs. It was just a way for them to simply run their cash flow and lock up the pub in a efficient way and have everything nicely documented, all that sort of stuff. And that did all right. Sold to quite a few pubs, and it just piqued my interest in learning more about IT. And so then, while still working in hospitality, kind of part time, I went and did some study and formal study in IT, and enough to kind of work out a, you know, enough to have a really nice base knowledge of a lot of different facets of IT. Mm-hmm. And took a focus on the marketing and internet side of things, and so started working for a computer games company, building websites for them and promoting them in the search engines and learning all about online marketing, which is really what the first company that we started was a online marketing search engine optimization company.
Called Sinewave, is that right?
Sinewave Interactive, that's right.
What was SEO like back in 1997?
What was it?
Yeah, I mean, what were you doing from an SEO perspective? This is, we're talking pre-Google 97, or it might have
pre-Google. I mean, it was search engines like AltaVista were the popular ones back then. There was about, and no one search engine really dominated. There was quite a broad landscape of search engines that were all reasonably popular, and so SEO involved submitting sites to, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 major search engines, and learning about how to optimize a page on a website that was tailored for each individual engine. Nowadays, it's the SEO and SEM industry, and it's a little bit different. You know, there's three or four major players, and it's a lot simpler because you can basically just buy your way into a search result rather than having to create pages that the search engine algorithms were wanting to see and that were relevant for the ultimate result that the searcher was after.
And how did Sinewave become Hitwise? At what point did you guys think that grabbing this intelligence was going to be a good business model?
Well, we started the company with three different business models that were all kind of competing for our attention in a lot of ways. The first was the SEO company, and that was the one that was able to get us really good cash flow from the start. So, you know, it was immediately a profitable business. There was no one doing that outside of the States at that point. And, you know, we were the first people to kind of go to the ad agencies and say that we could optimize their website. It was really popular. We had no problem selling it at all. And so it just generated nice cash flow. We also had the idea of a popularity-powered search engine, and we put out a site called top100.com.au.
I remember
which
that.
Actually became a very popular search engine in its own right, which we could tell because we had the Hitwise service as well. It was the third business, which was the competitive intelligence-focused business and ranking service. You know, all three businesses were all unique and all a little bit different. The first one providing us good cash flow. The second one was a great consumer play with an advertising model, and the third one was what ultimately became, I suppose, the globally successful one, and the one that we took international, which was the Hitwise competitive intelligence service, and that one needed a little, you know, a lot more of the R&D in the early days to build all the technology that collected the data and all the tools and technologies that we then provide clients via a web interface to analyze and understand that data better.
And your approach to grabbing that data was fairly original, wasn't it?
Well, the landscape back then for internet measurement was that you had three different ways you could do it. You could either measure the traffic to your own website, which pretty much everyone did, and it was a pretty flooded market with lots of different tools that you could use to understand what was going on your own website. And it was called the site-centric industry, as you know, everyone's got some kind of site-centric tool, whether it be Web Trends or Red Sheriff or whatever it was at that time. Then at the other end, you've got the benchmarking tools, which, or the audience measurement you know, businesses. And then back then, it was a company called Mediametrics in the States, mm-hmm. and they had adopted the same methodology that companies use to measure television audiences, where they recruit a panel of users, put a little box on top of their television set in the instance of TV measurement. And similarly, in the internet, they just put some software on their computer that tracks the websites that they visit. And then they extrapolate that sample up to, you know, a representative estimate of the universe that you know, tells us that we all watch CSI on a Sunday night, or tell us that we all visit 9MSN as the most popular site. And that's, I suppose, where we saw a real opportunity to develop a business that could go a lot further than that, because the panel-based methodology, as it's called, which is where you recruit these households, putting them on your panel, doesn't scale very well for the internet. And the main difference between the internet and television is that television's got a few channels, whereas the internet's got millions of channels, and so having a small number of households on your panel doesn't scale very well when you're trying to show all of the websites that people visit. And so we thought, well, you can never get enough people on your panel to make it truly representative and deep of true internet activity, of all the websites that people can potentially visit in a given period. And we thought about it more from a technical point of view and thought, well, the internet backbone is kind of controlled by ISPs. If we work out a way of measuring the network, we would be able to see much larger volumes of data and therefore measure many, many more websites, and therefore provide a measurement service to, you know, hundreds of thousands of businesses rather than just a few thousand. And so that's what we did. We worked with ISPs, we developed technology that sits on their network, and we were able to anonymously aggregate all of this usage information from millions of users and provide a measurement service that went a lot deeper than anything that had come before it. And it was quite unique, and that's what we pushed into other markets, and it was, you know, equally successful in the UK as it was here and in the US.
Who was your first ISP?
A small ISP in Australia that we went along and said, you know, we've got this crazy idea to you know, extract data off your network, and we want to pay you for it. And the ISP had kind of never had anyone come along and offer to buy what was effectively, you know, they didn't even realise that there was any value in it. That was kind of their rubbish. It was just, at that point, it was just log files from proxy caches. And so, you know, they'd never really had anyone come approach them and ask for that kind of data. And so we showed up and said we want to buy it from them, and it was quite a novel idea, and they gave it a go. And I remember one ISP saying to me recently that back in those days there was a lot of companies that thought that the ISPs were the gateway to the consumer on the internet, and that if you could partner with the ISPs, you could sell anything through to the consumer. And so they had so many companies coming and offering them partnerships in this and that and the other thing. And he said we were the only company they really partnered with in that 99, 2000, 2001 period, where we kept coming back each quarter with checks paying for that data that kept increasing in size. And most ISPs that did deals with companies rarely got a return on that deal. It never kind of, you know, came through to fruition what was promised by the potential company. And so it was nice to hear that from an ISP, that, you know, we were one of the few that actually kept coming back and giving them more and more money each time.
So that was the business model. You offered to buy this data from the ISPs. Were you paying for it in advance, or were you paying for it a percentage of revenues? What was the model?
Well, it was a mix, and it was different. Back then, we were trying lots of different models. So it was at one point it was a percentage, and for some partners a percentage of the revenue. Sometimes it was, depending on which market you're in, it was paying for it based on a subscriber count. But typically, it was all based on the volume of data that they were able to provide into the mix, and they would get a return on the mix that was available back to the ISPs based on the amount of data they gave us.
And is that the model that's prevalent today?
Sorry, what was that?
Is that still your model today?
Yes, yeah. It's worked quite well, and there's been no real need to change it. The ISPs get a lot out of it. They get remuneration in the form of money. They get also access, which in some cases is actually more important than the money itself. They get access to a version of Hitwise that's based on just their own users, which helps them with their content portal plays, which helps them to reduce churn, a whole range of different things that, that provide ISPs with, you know, lots of added value in understanding in a little bit more detail what their how their users are using the internet.
And to develop the technology to do this on the back end, did you guys have, did you develop it yourself? Did you acquire it?
No, we pretty much developed everything ourselves. So from the technology that processes logs to the technology that creates logs to the technology that then aggregates it all up and ships it between ISPs and our central warehouse, and then, you know, the database infrastructure that builds it from there, and then the front end product that displays it all. And that's been evolving over the years, so that, you know, we constantly add new ways of clients being able to understand how consumers interact with their competitors' websites, where their competitors get traffic from, what search terms are driving that traffic, how you know, how popular they are relative to their competitors, and how they can learn from their competitors' marketing strategies to get smarter about their own online marketing.
So is it just a big database exercise with a web front end?
Well, that's simplifying it terribly, Cameron.
But I don't want to do it injustice, but yeah.
And, you know, it's a lot of, I mean, there's 25 million people on the, that we're analysing each day all around the world. It's a lot of data that's aggregated and processed. But it's a very distributed processing model, so we have a lot of processing that the ISPs do, and that they just send us summary aggregate data. It uses a very distributed model, which is quite good from a central processing point of view, that we don't have to have huge, you know, supercomputers to analyze all this data. It's kind of quite spread out. And the database infrastructure is one that's evolved over the years. It's a pretty key part of what we do, you know, one that we've kind of built on open source, you know, relatively well known, but I suppose a lot of the processes on top of the database are very proprietary to how we process and present the data. And then the application to view it all via the web is something that, you know, we've become pretty good at developing good visualization tools over the years, and you know, the advances in the languages that you can use to present that data online have been good to us, and we've certainly been at the, I suppose, the cutting edge of visualization tools and being able to process and present that data in a way that makes it really easy for companies to action it and to go away and improve their search marketing campaign or establish partnerships with other companies based on what they see in their competitors' data and so on.
I wanted to ask you about that. In the last couple of years, we've seen a number of services like Alexa or Compete.com rise up, which are pretty popular in the Web 2.0 space for helping businesses and also helping VCs get a perspective on which websites are getting increasing traffic. And I think the general consensus is that the information that we get from those is pretty dodgy, but it's the best that you can get for free.
Yeah, and there is I think there'll always be a growing number of free services of people just putting out data about what they can, you know, wherever they can get data, they'll just process it and try and put out some kind of intelligence about it. But I suppose we've really taken the high ground over the years in that we wanted to create a truly representative and robust and much more accurate service that that people would want to pay for and do pay for. And our growth in popularity is, I suppose, testament to the fact that clients do want, you know, accountability, and they want representative data, and they want to make sure that the way that it's presented and the way that it's classified and the way that it's it can be used is credible and authentic, and that's what we're focused on.
Sucking it straight out of an ISP's logs is going to be a lot more representative and accurate, you would hope, than a certain group of people that have a toolbar installed.
Our view has always been you want to have a nice mix of data. So you want to have your ISP data, but you also want to mix in your opt-in panel data. You know, the combination of both is what creates a much more representative sample of data.
Hmm. And so how much, tell us about the capital raising in the early days. I read somewhere in my research that you raised about $30,000 in angel money early on. Is that correct?
Yeah, I can't remember the exact figures, but it was probably around that. I mean, the cash flow from the SEO company, from Sinewave, whilst consistent, you know, wasn't able to grow at the rate we wanted to grow the other businesses that we were building. And so, you know, ultimately we had to start raising money to get that growth going. And so we started with a little bit of friends and family, angel kind of investors. But I suppose really we decided that as soon as we'd got the technology right in Australia, we said we need to get this into as many countries as possible. The only way we can really do that is to raise some serious money. And so, you know, our first serious capital raising was around the $6 million mark in early 2000.
Did you raise that locally or offshore?
Yeah, locally. And we did actually travel a bit to the US, you know, just to talk to a few VCs over there. But we, you know, predominantly they just wanted us to become a US company straight away, and we thought, no, we're just happy being Australian. We don't want to jump, you know, we don't want to do a flip up too quickly. And so we had raised it from some Melbourne high net worth individuals around Melbourne, predominantly. You know, they were very supportive to the company, and they helped us grow here. And then ultimately we then took on VCs that were able to grow us internationally, and they were based in New York.
And they
that
were
was around they about were happy, two, 3 years after the first one.
And they were happy to put the funds in without you moving your headquarters to New York?
They actually approached us to raise to invest. We actually never needed or really wanted the money that badly at that point. They were just a very proactive venture firm out of New York that were looking around for good businesses that were growing fast, and had we fitted their mold perfectly. And so they were kind of talking to us for almost a year before we finally agreed to, you know, sell down some of our shares to bring them in. And that was probably one of the better decisions we made over the years, because it's you know, they were a real VC, one that was able to properly help us and help us to grow, which was a little different to the experience we obviously had in Australia. So we were a bit burnt by VCs in Australia, but then we got a lot of confidence, and it ended up being a very good decision to bring these guys in.
There's a couple of interesting things you've said there, because, you know, the turning down the opportunity early on to take US money that required you to move over there. I mean, there's a lot of Australian entrepreneurs who have done that over the years, and obviously there's a lot today that have either moved or in the process of moving to the Bay Area in particular to raise money. But you guys declined that opportunity. What was your thinking behind that at the time?
Just, the unknown of it, and the fact that, you know, we thought that going into the US market at that point might be a little bit premature. You know, just becoming too US-centric at that point might be the wrong move. I suppose over the top of all of that, it was just the fear of the unknown of being, you know, a valley company at that point. We were just still quite young as a business, and young as, I suppose, people. In hindsight, though, I think, you know, taking Australian VC versus US VC, you know, I think if I had my time all over again, there's no way I would have taken the Australian VC, because it just adds no value at all, and in fact just distracts you and takes value away. So, you know, but US VCs have got a completely different attitude, completely different resources at their disposal, and are able to provide heaps of value. And, you know, so perhaps, you know, in hindsight, maybe we should have taken the US VC at that point, and we may have been, might have been a different picture. But, I mean, I'm certainly not complaining.
When you say they add value, what kind of value? Is it about their network, their ability to help you close deals?
They're just more resourced to help their portfolio companies.
Yeah.
Whereas Australian VCs are just worried about, you know, that A, they have no resources to help. B, they don't really, a lot of them don't even have the experience to help. And C, they've usually made some bad investments which consumed all of their time anyway. And so they just become a distraction to you. Whereas in the US, they have a lot of analysts that work on the team that are there to help the portfolio companies. They just have very credible, experienced partners that can, you know, sit on the board and help strategically help, even not so much operationally, but kind of with deals that you're doing in the States and with the network and the credibility that's helpful to get those deals done. They're just extremely supportive. And I suppose, I don't know, maybe we just got lucky with the VCs that we had. But I do think that there is a very polar difference between Australian VCs and US VCs that's just quite extraordinary from my experience.
Interesting that you say that the New York VCs came along when you didn't really need and weren't looking for the money. What advice would you give to Aussie startup entrepreneurs today who are looking to raise some capital? How do you think they should go about it?
Well, I think if they're looking to take the business overseas, like if they're wanting to grow the business outside of Australia, looking at international VCs would definitely be a good thing to do from my experience, and something that, there are a lot of VCs over in the States that are looking outside of the US for deal flow that, you know, there's a lot of, they've usually had some good experiences with European or Asian or Australian businesses. They're not scared of investing in something that might not be a US entity. I think VCs have kind of been thinking outside of the box quite a bit over the last few years, and you know the opportunities are not as, you know, what, there's a lot of competition for the good opportunities in the States, and so those VCs that do look offshore are usually proactive, usually experienced in dealing with different cultural businesses, and usually have a lot to offer.
That's interesting, because I spent a bit of time over in the Bay Area late last year, and the people that I met over there gave me the impression that they don't look outside of about, what's the old saying, about a 20-minute drive for investments.
Yeah, right. And that's where there's, a lot of competition for some VCs, and I suppose it depends who you talk to. Some VCs are very proactive in going international. Some VCs are very, inner-centric and just looking at what's local, and they've probably got enough deal flow locally to not get distracted by overseas investors. But I suppose one other dynamic that happens with VCs is they sometimes develop a specialty. So like our VCs, for example, develop a specialty around software as a service businesses, and you kind of run out of them in your own market, even in a market the size of the US. There's only so many that can be that are at the right time in their life to be invested in by a fund of the size that they've invested in us. And so they, I suppose, were almost compelled to look offshore because they ran out of perfect deal flow in their own market. So if there are VCs that take a specialty in the business that you're in, they'd be an obvious target to approach, because they are probably also the ones that are looking offshore.
Tell me what you think about the internet online space in Australia. You've been around it for 10 years now. What are your thoughts at a high level about the Australian market?
Well, that's a pretty broad question.
Yeah, well, it's an open broad question.
What do I think about it?
Have you seen lots of genuine innovation come out of the Australian marketplace, or are we followers? Are we leaders or followers in this space?
I think that we're leaders in lots of different ways, but I think we also have an opportunity to learn from experienced businesses in other markets and develop an Australian variation on an international theme. Mm-hmm. And that's been quite successful. There's a few different examples of that. There's nothing wrong with that. If you see, it's a lot easier to start a business where there's been a precedent in another market with a successful operation, and then just sort of take an Australian slant on it, bring it into Australia, and build a successful business off the back of that. I suppose the only challenge with that is that you then limit your international growth prospects, because usually the rest of the world is taken by the company you've kind of learnt from, and you've limited your market to Australia because you're just doing an Australian variation on an international theme. But Australia is not a tiny market. We're growing. We've got a booming economy, and it's a good time to be building a business in Australia right now.
Obviously, the investment climate in Australia, you don't sound like you're a big fan of that.
No, I'm not. I think it's a necessary thing. I suppose my comments have been that around that have been that you know, the Australian, I wouldn't expect too much from an Australian VC. And it's purely because of the market size. It's not their fault. It's just that they just don't have the size and the scope and the experience to really help companies that want to go international. But if all you want to do is build a business in Australia, you know, there's, I mean, that's probably more where their specialties lie.
Different requirements. You mentioned recently, I think in your speech at the Churchill Club, something about your business in a box philosophy. Can you take us through that?
Yeah, so that was one of the, I suppose one of the focuses we always had was to try to make expanding the businesses as easy as possible from one market to the next. And so in everything that we did, we tried to build processes around it. We tried to think about the business almost like it was a franchise, even though we were the franchisor and the franchisee. And that, I suppose, whilst it didn't go across everything we did, it went across a lot of things that we did, and it was a mindset that was helpful because when it did come time to go into a new market, we could just, you know, like, I suppose, using the analogy of pick up the box, take it over to the new market, unpack it all, and you've got all the manuals of how to run Hitwise in that market. It probably sounds a lot easier than the reality of what it was, but it was a mindset that was certainly helpful in being able to launch into lots of countries at, you know, in a very short space of time.
So was that the objective, to be able to enable you to rapidly ramp up in new markets, or was it so somebody could come in and buy the business and not require the founders to know how to run it?
Well, that was, well, yeah, that was another reason. I suppose also that that we were approached quite a bit from smaller markets to license the technology to build a Hitwise in that smaller market. And so whilst we never really went ahead with any of those deals, we were always thinking that if one day we did want to go ahead with those deals, we'd want it to be done correctly. And so, you know, building it in a box was nice, was a nice concept for that opportunity. But also the tyranny of distance, even though the internet reduces that, you still, when you build a business in the UK, it's a bloody long way away. And, you know, there was a lot of challenges that we faced with putting executives over in new markets, kind of building those markets by themselves. They did a tremendous job of it, but it was a challenging time. And the more that we could do to support them by giving them all the tools and techniques that we possibly could, you know, before they went and in those early days of building the business, I think it was ultimately a lot more helpful for them.
Speaking of the tyranny of distance, Experian, the new owners, are based in the US. Does this require you guys to move over there, or are you going to keep running it from Melbourne?
No, they're actually quite a global business, Experian, and their base is in Ireland.
Oh.
But they are, they're on the FTSE 100 index on the London Stock Exchange.
Right.
But they have a very, very large presence in America. I mean, they've got about 13,500 people in the organisation. It's a very large, very, very large company.
Yeah.
So they have offices everywhere. And that was one of the attractive things about them, in that they, you know, I mean, they've got quite a presence here of about 100 staff in here in Melbourne. So, you know, they're helpful in that we, A, think globally. They don't think locally, and they are going to be very helpful for us to get into new markets a lot quicker than we otherwise could. They're just, you know, it's great to have that global network that we can grow into, and that's what Experian comes with.
And you guys have got an earn-out as part of the acquisition, I imagine. You're going to be sticking around for a while?
It was a pretty clean deal, which was another one of the attractive things about it for us. So no, there's no earn-outs. It was all just a straight, clean-cut deal. Another nice thing, I suppose, of having experienced US VCs to help negotiate that. But it was, I suppose, as good a deal as you could hope for, really. But as far as me hanging around, I mean, there's no plans for me to move on. I'm quite happy to help integrate and build Hitwise up under the Experian umbrella for the time being.
So, What does the new wealth mean for you? You're in your early 30s now. What does this mean for you lifestyle-wise? You've hit the jackpot. There's, you know, the thousands and thousands of entrepreneurs dreaming of this day. How does it, you know, what does it do to your psyche? Is it just business as usual for you? What's it going to mean?
Yeah, it kind of is business as usual. You don't really, it doesn't really change your psyche much. I mean, having, I suppose, the financial freedom is a nice thing.